Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by The Journal, a new monthly email newsletter from Kevin Rose. To gain insider access to Kevin's best of the web, sign up today for free at www.thejournal.email. And by Varidesk. Varidesk easily converts your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk so you can switch between sitting and standing to stay fit and active at work. Learn more at Varidesk.com. That's V-A-R-I-Desk.com. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/NSS.
Cheap Android phones, a truly hands-free car phone mount, and using lasers to blast space rocks to save the planet. Live from the Twit Brick House in beautiful downtown Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
Good. All right, I want you to do it again, Greg, but this time I want you to do it in a Christopher Walken voice, all right? Hey, thanks, everybody. Welcome to the new Screensavers. Leo Laporte here.
I'm Ron Richards. Good to be back.
Bill Gaines was right.
He was.
I love that.
He was.
And anybody who's a fan of the network probably has heard Dick DiBartolo talk about this genesis of Mad Magazine.
Yep.
And Bill Gaines, who created it.
Yeah, the head of EC Comics back in the day, some of the best horror and crime comics and things like that.
But
the culture of fear of the 50s shut it all down.
The comic book code said you can't do this.
It was pre-comic code. The comic code resulted from that. There was hearing. Dr. Frederick Wortham said the seduction of the innocent. Said comic books were causing the juvenile delinquency.
Oh, we got trouble.
Yeah.
Right here in River City. Yep. And it starts with a C.
Then they formed the comics code, and then that's why we had no cursing or violence or anything in comics for 20, 30 years.
But we also got Mad Magazine.
We did, yes. Yeah, there's something,
Anyway, it's great to have Ron here. As you know, a host of All About Android and a regular Twit.
Yeah.
Love having you here. And I have, because you're here, I have a gift for you.
Oh, wow. Flattered.
I have created for you, for your Robin. You still use the Nextbit
Robin? I do. My trusty Nextbit Robin here. My new phone.
I think you're going to be excited about this.
Yeah?
A solid gold SIM holder.
Oh, wow.
Actually, this came to me from Robin.
I had no idea. This
and I've already given my Robin to somebody else, right? So I think, who do I know has one of these? They sent me this as a thank you, because I was a Kickstarter guy.
Oh, wow.
And it says, stay gold, Rebel. Thanks for believing in us. And here you go, Ron, just for you.
Wow.
It's the least I could do, literally. The least I could do. And I don't believe it's actual gold. It's just gold colored, but a gold colored SIM holder.
That would replace that white one.
That replaces
right there.
The white one. And when people see that, it's kind of like having red brake calipers on your Tesla. They know that you're in the special club.
Now, too bad it's not rose gold, or my All About Android co-host Florence Ion would be very jealous, because she's
jealous.
A sucker for the rose gold devices. So, but still, I'm flattered. Thank you so
much. Funny?
This came
today, and I thought, well, it's too bad I gave the phone
away. It's a great phone, though.
Do you love it still?
I love it. Yeah, this is my first non-Nexus phone. I've been on the Nexus program since the first phone.
It's pretty close to Nexus.
Yeah,
are
it's
you
very close.
Now the only thing I it's a little odd. It only has 32 gigs of memory, and then when you run out of space, it starts to upload your apps to the cloud, and then their desktop will show you kind of a ghost of that app.
Yep.
But that means you have to use their launcher, and I wanted, I like Nova Launcher.
It will work. The backing up will work without their launcher.
Right, but you don't get the ghost.
But you don't get the ghost. That's the thing. But you do get the backup. You can go see what apps are backed up and all that sort of stuff. You just don't get the neat little animation.
So do you use the Robin Launcher?
I am still on the Robin Launcher, but purely out of laziness. I haven't actually switched back to, I want to go back to the Google Launcher.
Yeah.
That's Memorial Day weekend. That's my plan. That's my project on Monday.
Wow.
But,
you live large.
But I haven't, but I actually, I know, but I.
You know what I'm doing this Memorial Day weekend? I just want to tell you, I am going to change my Android
weekend.
Launcher.
But I actually haven't had anything back up because I've been on the Nexus 5 on a 16 gig phone.
You're used to. 32.
So I'm well under the minimum, so I haven't actually had anything get backed up yet. So
it cracks me up that we act like 16, 32 gigs, oh, that's hardly anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm old enough to remember 2 gigabyte hard drives, but that was a big deal,
I remember in eighth grade, my dad got me a double stack 500 meg hard drive.
500 megabytes! 500 meg,
and it was like this, it was 5 1/4 inch width, but double height. Heavy as hell.
I mean,
hell.
You felt like, I'm never going to fill that thing up.
I put all my Sierra games on there.
There you go.
It was great. Yeah, those classics.
Oh, it's when games were small and men were men. Big stories in the news. We should cover a couple of them. I know you probably cover them on All About Android this week. I certainly will on This Week in Google. On Friday, the jury came back in the Oracle versus Google case. The genesis of this case was crazy, and we've covered it on the show, but just to give you kind of a recap, when Google created Android, actually probably predated Google, when Andy Rubin created Android, they decided to use Java. They went and they talked to Sun, the creators of Java, and decided not to license Android, but instead to not copy it, but to, in a clean room environment, recreate it. And in the past, this has been kind of the legal thing to do. The folks at Sun, I remember talking to the James Gosling, the guy who wrote Java, created Java. He said, we felt like we'd been slimed, that Google probably did look at the source code because it was open source and maybe copied a few things. There were 9 specific lines of code in array checker in Java that said, oh, this looks exactly the same. See, he said, we felt kind of slimed. Jonathan Schwartz, the CEO at the time of Sun, felt kind of slimed, but they weren't going to sue about it. It was just like, oh, guys, come on, license the thing. But they didn't. Meanwhile, along comes Oracle. They buy Sun for a lot of money, and Oracle... apparently, according to Gosling, their lawyers' eyes lit up when they heard about this Java thing, and Oracle saw that as a potential way to maybe make some of that money back that they paid for it. Oracle did, in fact, go after Google, saying, hey, Google, you stole our code. But the lawyers, and Gosling told me this as well, realized that they weren't going to be able to win a case where they had to get a jury to look at the code and say they stole the code. They tried the case. The judge, in fact, Judge Alsup, said, I learned Java just to do this. And in fact, this is fine. It's legit. Google wins. Oracle appealed. And due to a weird loophole in the courts, because there was some patent stuff involved, it went to the federal court in D.C. instead of the Ninth Circuit here on the West Coast. The federal court has a different kind of relationship to patents and intellectual property. And Oracle didn't pursue this over, oh, they stole it. They said, we want to copyright the API. We want to make it so they can't clean room reverse engineer it. The federal court said, you're right. It is copyrighted. Google appeals to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says, no, wait a minute. You got to stop. First, get this copyright thing out of the way. So it went back to Judge Alsup, and that's the trial that just ended.
Yep.
10 jury of their peers, 10 angry men or whatever, got to hear this whole testimony, not about whether Google stole the code, not about whether the code was copyrightable. Both of those things were agreed upon. Whether the API was copyrightable, is whether that Google's use of the API constituted fair use of a copyrighted product. And there's 4 tests for fair use. And, you know, we do fair use. You know, when we show something on the news, it's fair use.
It's our main defense, I think. I just went through a legal thing as well where I pleaded fair use and was able to get around it.
If you get a takedown on YouTube, if you can justify it saying, look, it's fair use, you're probably going to win, especially if you're a news organization.
And partially because the argument to prove it's not fair use is way more expensive and long and, you know, and it becomes a resources issue. But
well,
Google and Oracle have resources.
They have resources. They had indicated at the beginning of the trial that they were going to look for massive damages, like $9 billion in damages. Anyway, the good news, it's over. The judge and jury say they don't contest whether the API is copyrightable. They don't talk about whether Google stole the code. But whatever they did was fair use, and so they're off the hook. Now, of course, Oracle says we'll appeal.
Of course.
It will probably go back to that federal court. They could... Who knows what's going to happen? But anyway...
But it's a victory for fair use.
A victory for fair use.
And it's kind of hard because Oracle's whole kind of argument is that, well, we could have done Android and Google stole the success that we could have had, but they didn't.
Like, well, in fact, they did. They made a Java phone, and it was a flop.
Exactly.
It was a flop. Yeah. But that was their real contention, was, look, see, because of Android, we weren't able to properly monetize. Yeah. And that's, by the way, one of the four tests of fair use is if it costs you money, right?
Yeah.
And in this case, the jury said, no, you guys didn't have a shot. So, good news. Not over.
Yeah.
These things never end. But Google keeps winning, so I have a feeling that this will go well. There's a little bit of a furor going around now over Windows 10. Do you use Windows in any form or fashion?
I said goodbye to Windows in 2007 and never looked back.
Yeah, you don't miss it, do you?
Don't miss it at all. although I, every now and then I find myself, a friend has a question, or I find myself in front of a Windows machine, and then I frantically try to remember how to manipulate that and do it, and make it all work. I hear Windows 10 is good, though.
Yeah, I like Windows 10. In fact, I want to say this right up front. If you're getting a new computer like this new HP I'm going to review later, get Windows 10. If you have an old computer and you've got the free upgrade, get Windows 10. No. But at the same time, I really defend the people's right not to upgrade, right? It's your computer. Just because Microsoft's very anxious for you to use Windows 10, you should be able to stick with Windows 7 or Windows 8.1. Microsoft's made that harder and harder to do, first nudging you like crazy, saying, come on, you want to upgrade? You got a free upgrade. Next, unfortunately, putting the upgrade into the recommended updates, which for many Windows 7 and 8.1 users means they got it whether they wanted it or not, because by default, recommended upgrades are automatic.
Right. And it gets confusing to the user because it's recommended and it affects their decision. Yeah.
The latest, and this happened this week, is they changed the dialog box. Let me see if I'm going to have to find a copy of the dialog box, actually. If anybody is a Windows 10 fan, it would be Paul Thurrott, the host of Windows Weekly, the author of the blogger at Thurrott.com. He says Microsoft's upgrade deceptions are undermining Windows 10. And the latest one is the dialog box. And believe it or not, I'm going to defend Microsoft in this. Let me see if I can find the dialog box. The Windows 10 upgrade. So, actually, can you find it, Brian, while I talk about it? Just look for Windows 10 upgrade box, and you'll see it. If you were a normal user, you had recommended upgrades turned on, you were using Windows 7 or 8.1, and Microsoft had validated it was compatible, Microsoft in the background would download the Windows 10 installer, 3 gigabytes, boom, off your hard drive. And in fact, if it gets far enough along, we'll expand it into 8 gigabytes. So that's without your approval or knowledge. Then it will pop up a box that says, hey, good news. No. We have scheduled... Nope, that's not it. I'm going to see if I can find it. Windows 10 Deceptive Upgrade Dialog. I should be able to find that. It will then show you... Let me see if I can get a screenshot of it. Yeah, here it is. It will then show you this box. And this box is saying exactly...
Oh, man, look at that.
Well, okay, a couple of problems with this. Now, I want you to read what it's saying. Based on your Windows update settings, that's the thing it was recommended, right? This PC, listen carefully, is scheduled to upgrade on Monday. Now, it then goes on to say, click here to change upgrade schedule or cancel scheduled upgrade. But most people aren't going to click here.
Right.
They're going to look down at this button that says, okay. No, don't want it. This is enough. I want you to tell me what to do. If you don't want Windows 10, no, I can't click OK. What's the cancel box says? Upgrade now. Okay. So what's that saying actually is?
It's saying don't do it at 11. Do it right now.
Do it right now. I'm in a hurry.
Yeah.
But what a lot of people have been doing is click this red X.
Yep.
Cancel. Now, here's what Paul says. By the way, that behavior changed. It used to cancel it. Now it just closes the window.
Sure, yeah.
What Paul says is, well, that's deceptive. Because you think you've canceled, but in fact you haven't. And so Microsoft's tricking you, in effect, to an upgrade. Mm-hmm. I agree this isn't a very well-designed box. It probably should have a big cancel button somewhere.
Yep.
But it is pretty clear, that if you read this, and this is the problem, nobody reads these, it does say click here to change upgrade schedule or cancel. That's not hidden.
But that's in the second smallest font. And this is classic UI Microsoft
trickery.
I wouldn't say trickery, but it's this is the intersection between Microsoft's intended experience for Windows and that they want everyone to upgrade up against respecting the user and building a UI that informs and enables the user to do what they want with their computer. In this case, give me the choice to upgrade or not.
So here's I'm going to defend Microsoft.
Yeah. Okay.
I understand the developers at Microsoft were thinking. They said, no, look, it's already scheduled. You have recommended updates turned on. We've downloaded it. We've scheduled it.
Just letting
all
you know.
This box is saying is it's scheduled. And closing the box doesn't change that.
Right.
Clicking upgrade now only makes it happen sooner. Okay doesn't change it. We put a it's admittedly not the biggest, but we did, you know, sorry, they wouldn't let us make it bigger font, but we did put this sentence, click here to change upgrade schedule or cancel scheduled upgrade. So I understand the thinking of a developer that says, well, no, obviously, if you click cancel, it doesn't cancel the upgrade. Right. It just closes that notice.
It's going to happen at 11
p.m.
It's
scheduled.
Anyway. Yeah.
If you want to change it, you have to proactively either go into updates or click that button, which we gave you. So I understand their thinking.
It's a little heads I win, tails you lose.
It's a little bit of that,
because you're kind of taking away the users. But the thing is, they have recommended updates checked, but a lot of users might not know they have that there.
Mike, well, that's the other thing. Microsoft says, we told you.
Yeah.
Now, if you listen to Windows Weekly or you read Windows magazines, maybe they told you, but it wasn't like they bought billboards or bought ads and said, oh, by the way. They didn't tell you in big letters.
Yeah.
They told you in little tiny letters. Anyway, Steve Gibson's written a really great program, which works in this case as well. Never 10. Download it. It's free from grz.com.
Never 10.
Well, he doesn't like Windows 10. And if you run it, what it does is makes the changes, Microsoft's recommended changes to the registry that will prevent the pop-up.
Yeah.
There's a button on there that says delete the downloaded files, and that will fix it. But if you're worried about that, and this is what Paul's saying. A, this cheeses people off and really downgrades people's impression of Windows 10 and Microsoft.
Which Paul thinks is a good product.
Right,
yeah,
and
so,
I agree with him.
Yeah.
The other thing he's pointing out is that we will maybe encourage people to turn off updates.
Right.
And that's not what you want to
do.
It's
dangerous.
It's very dangerous. Turn off recommended updates, that's safe, but you must have automatic critical updates on. You really do want to have
that. That dialogue box reminds, speaking of Oracle, reminds me of the, if you upgrade your Java runtime environment, they'll hit you with a make Yahoo your default search engine box. And it's worded in a way that's like, wait, I'm saying no to this, but, you know, and it's very deceptive. And that reminds me a lot of that, unfortunately.
This is a little pet hobby horse of mine now, which is that companies, for a while, a very small, brief period of time, there was this impression that if you really serve the customer, you're going to do well.
Yep.
You know, we're customer-centric. We care about the customer. We're going to do the right thing for them. Even like Amazon, we do the right thing. Nobody does that anymore. Amazon says, hey, we're not going to sell anything that's competitive to us, like that Apple TV thing. Apple says, we're not going to let you use any Amazon stuff. Microsoft says, everybody's looking out for themselves. There's no consumer-centric anymore. That makes me sad.
It is a little sad. I mean, but then at the same time, you've got companies like Google and Samsung, stuff like that, who are making product announcements, and the key announcement is that we've listened to our customers.
Yeah.
We've gotten that feedback, but we're going to make a VR camera that only works with our phone.
we decided not to do it.
That's the capitalism problem.
Yeah, it's the capitalism problem. All right, enough. Hey, thank you for being here.
Yeah,
I really
course.
Love having
always,
you on the
it's
show.
Always great to be
Bill
here.
Gaines was right.
Yep.
And now let's get our first call for help. Let's go to Australia. Nick is on the line. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Leo.
Are you the Nick that I know from years gone by? Is it the same Nick?
Yep.
Yep.
It's a reunion.
Yep. He's happy about it, too. You can tell. It's great.
Last time we did this was on one of the final recording sessions of the lab with Leo.
That's what I thought. Well, it's nice to see you again. And, boy, look at these... you've got to be... Your mouth's got to be watering at these action figures behind Nick there.
Cool.
Although... All Transformers, or
all the ones you can see there are Transformers. I've got a couple of Star Wars figures here and there, but and some Power Rangers, but yeah, mostly Transformers.
I noticed Optimus Prime is on the top shelf.
No, that's actually the that's the Constructicons, right? Am I right? Is it the
Yep. That's the
child of the 80s.
That's what
there
I get for trying
smaller
for pretending
robots.
I understand anything at all about this genre. All right, Nick, what can we do for you?
Okay, so people seem to realize when, you know, a person's a geek, and then they start asking questions, and then, you know, the subject of Android might come up, and I honestly have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to Android. So I was hoping that maybe you guys could recommend some cheap Android phones that I could look at to buy so that I can, you know, basically use them as a test device and find out, you know, exactly how to use Android so that when people ask me questions, I'm not completely out of my depth.
So this is good. So this is not to recommend to other people. This is so you can become an expert on Android.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And if you're a geek or you're a developer, you know, like, it's good to be, it's like, I should be a little more versed in Windows. Like, that's the, you know, it's good to know all the different things, especially if you're developing applications and you want to know, if you're developing web applications, you want to see how they behave on the different platforms. So it's good to have a phone handy to see what it looks like. And,
and we were talking earlier about a friend of, mutual friend of ours, who is an iPhone bigot, who everyone, and he knows that you host All About Android, and you love Android, and he every once in a while tests you to see if Android's gotten any better. And one of the things I pointed out is that's very commonly the case with people who are big iPhone fans, is they've used Android so little, it seems a lot harder to them.
Yep.
And probably goes the other way around. If you've used Android your whole life and you start using an iPhone, it seems harder than it actually is because you're not fluent.
Right.
You're not fluent.
For me as an Android guy, iOS seems very adorably simple. Because they take away a lot of your choice and stuff like that, but that's another conversation. But anyway,
so Nick,
this is the right time for this question because this is probably the best time in the history of Android to get an affordable phone that is solid and pretty much current in terms of the current operating systems and the current level of apps. There's never been a better time to get affordable phones now. One of the ones that probably the first at the top of the pile that you want to take a look at is the Moto G from Motorola.
Oh, I couldn't agree. And this is they couldn't agree more, I should say. Not couldn't agree.
I couldn't agree
more. they just announced the new Moto Gs.
They did just announce the new Moto Gs. I would ignore the new Moto Gs for now because they basically – so the Moto G was Motorola's
budget phone.
Option phone. And it was a great entry point into Android. The previous version of it sells for about $200. You could now they've announced the new ones. You could probably find it cheaper. Here we see one for $154.
That's second generation, and we're now at the fourth.
Yeah, fourth generation, right.
So I wouldn't get the second.
I would get the third.
I think the third generation Moto Gs were my favorite inexpensive Android phones, and it's a pretty pure Android experience,
right? Yes, it is, because Motorola was previously owned by Google, and this was from the time period when Google controlled Motorola, so it's very pure, it's very kind of, it's clean, it's got a little bit of the Motorola stuff, but the Motorola stuff is actually pretty good, it's not like the bloatware like on HTC or on Samsung.
That's an important thing for you to know, Nick, is that unlike the iPhone, where all iPhones are exactly the same in terms of the operating system, Android phones vary wildly because LG puts their customizations on, Samsung's puts theirs, and those are really almost completely different phones.
It's a combination of UI skins plus custom apps and native apps and things like that. So the dialer on the Motorola phone might be different than on an HTC phone and that sort of thing.
But the purer the Google experience, the more that you're getting the Android experience as opposed to the Samsung or the LG
branded experience.
And Moto's pretty pure.
Moto's very pure. But if you want that true, pure Nexus Google experience, you've got a nice window of action you could take right now and get the old Nexus 5.
They're still selling it?
Well, no, Google's not selling it anymore, but you can still find it on Amazon. You can find it in other places. Sometimes you can find it used, but there's a lot of new ones still floating out there. In fact, Woot just had a deal like a week or so ago that was $150 for the Nexus 5.
That's a classic phone.
That phone, I ran that phone for 2.5 years as my daily driver, and if I didn't get the Nexus Robin, I would still be using it. I still have it.
If you had the 5, would you be on Marshmallow now?
Yes.
The other thing is, Android changes a lot from version to version. You want Android 6 so that you can be talking about the latest features. And, of course, the next generation is already in the works.
Yeah.
And would the Nexus 5 get Android N?
It should. Whether or not it's supported and runs is the open question.
So Google hasn't made any announcements.
Because they're in the process of sunsetting it. They just recently removed it from the Google Play Store.
How much?
You could probably find it for anywhere from $150 to $200 right now.
That's a great price. Yeah, that's a nice phone.
Yeah. And then if you want to spend a little more money, for $250, you could pick up the $250 US. I'm not doing the Australian currency rate. Sorry, Nick. But the OnePlus X is the startup OnePlus who made a lot of noise when they released the OnePlus One and the OnePlus Two, etc. They came out with the OnePlus X, which now sells for $199, which is a solid Moto G competitor almost. It's fair. It's running Cyanogen, so it's not true pure Google.
It's not Oxygen?
It's Cyanogen. It's their version of Cyanogen,
so
which is Oxygen. Yeah,
you can get Oxygen.
Yeah.
Which is as pure as it gets.
Right.
Oxygen is basically OnePlus rewrote Android to make it Oxygen. I don't know if they have Marshmallow yet or if they're still back.
I don't know where they're at with the update. I think it's coming soon.
But there's their OS. Yeah. That's a very fairly pure experience.
Yeah.
Although, again, notice how the settings looks a little different. Those are some differences. And that's going to be different across every platform except for Nexus.
Right.
Cyanogen is a big difference.
Yeah.
While I love Cyanogen, so what are they shipping their current phones with? Cyanogen 12?
I think they did move to fully
Oxygen.
Because the dust stuff of what happened in India caused them to move all the way to Oxygen because of the problem with Cyanogen.
I had the OnePlus One. I loved it. Put Oxygen on it. Was very happy. OnePlus 2 battery life went down a little bit.
Yeah.
Remember, though, that there's a OnePlus 3 coming out. Pretty soon. Now.
Yeah, but that's a higher end phone. The OnePlus
Those are
X,
be expensive.
Yeah, the OnePlus X was designed to be the more affordable phone.
And if it's running Oxygen, that is a very pure experience.
Yeah.
I think those are all good choices. Yeah. Is that roughly your price range, Nick? $100, $150 US?
Yeah. Well, I'm also going to do the same thing for Windows Phone, and I can pick up one of them for about 180 Australian.
If you wait a couple of weeks, that'll probably get cheaper.
I was just going to say, you might want to pull the trigger on the Android one first.
Well, I'm thinking like...
Who wants you to know how to use Windows Phone? Who's asking you about Windows phones?
Nobody, it's just curiosity.
Yeah. I got a BlackBerry. I'd be glad to sell you.
Wait, is it running Android?
No. You know, we got a Palm Pre over here.
Yeah,
you should really know how the Palm Pre works.
But of the three that we talked about, I would say look for a Nexus 5 if you can. I think that's
really
your best
pure,
bet.
Yeah, and also most likely to be upgradable to the next version of
exactly. For a little
system.
Bit at least. For at least the next year.
I saw the price of the Nexus 5X, and I was like, whoa, that's way too expensive for this project. But if the old Nexus 5 can be had cheaply, that's definitely an option.
Also, the Nexus 5X isn't the best phone. I love the Nexus 5. When they came with the Nexus 5X, I was going to get that. And a lot of the reviews and the experiences, in fact, my co-host on All About Android, Jason Howell's wife, got a Nexus 5X and had nothing but trouble. So
also bad battery life.
Yeah.
Although that may not matter to you so much, Nick, because this isn't going to be your daily driver, I presume.
No, not my daily driver.
Yeah. Battery life on the 5X was a little... But it's disappointing on the 5 as well. And the camera's not great on
I never
5.
Had a problem with the Nexus 5 on the battery side.
Yeah.
I have a great battery monitor app, and I always carry a battery with me.
What do you use for your battery
monitor? I use a... it's a weird name, but it's one that we reviewed years ago.
I thought you weren't supposed to use those anymore, right? I thought they caused more problems than they solved.
This one is called... Let me find about the app. It is called Battery Widget Reborn 2015.
Okay, I can't recommend that. I'm sorry.
No, but it's great because it gives me data, and look at that. I pull down from the notifications. I don't know if we can see.
I use GSAM for the data, but is it doing things like trying to improve battery life?
No, it's not trying to improve battery life.
Right.
It's just reporting.
Okay.
It's giving me an idea of how much more battery life I've got left.
Nice. Yeah.
And I've just been using it since the Nexus. Oh, geez. For years. I mean, since this app came out, so I'm a big fan.
I use GSAM when I'm reviewing phones because I want to use the same monitor each time, and I get a pretty good idea of battery life.
Yeah.
We do that because we need to say what the battery is.
Exactly.
Hey, Nick, it's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, great to talk to you too.
Glad to know we haven't lost you and your Transformers. Have a great one.
All right. Thanks, Leo.
Take care. Coming up next week, Jason Snell will be here. Of course, he's the Mac guru. We were going to do this week, I was going to install Chrome OS on a MacBook, but I thought it would really piss off Jason
more. That's a good idea, yeah. That'll be fun.
We're going to put that off to next week. If you have a question for our Mac guru, here's how you ask it.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
So if the big one, the big comet, the big asteroid is heading our way and Bruce Willis isn't available, what are we going to do? Coming up, a planetary scientist whose job is to save humanity from asteroids. This is she calls herself a planetary defender.
Wow.
This is awesome.
That's a pretty good business card.
This is awesome. And we're going to talk to Megan in just a second, but first a word from our sponsor, and I'm happy to say I'm also a little chagrined that our sponsor today is Kevin Rose. I told Kevin, I'll do that for free. He said, "No, Leo, I want to buy ads because I want everybody to know about the journal, and I think this is the best way to do it." I'm not going to tell him no. If he wants to buy an ad of the new screensavers, we love Kevin Rose. You saw him on the screensavers, the Dark Tipper. Even after the screensavers and Tech TV moved to L.A., he was there with the attack of the show. He, of course, invented Dig. He's the CEO of Hodinkee, which is a great watch company. He's really into watches. He's had several startups. He sold one to Google. I mean, this guy knows his stuff, and he's created a monthly, that's all, monthly newsletter. It's absolutely free, called The Journal. You know what? I think Kevin kind of misses doing the stuff he did on the screensavers and on Dig. I'm kind of just keeping up on what's going on. So this is his personal project to keep him up on the latest gadgets, on body hacks, podcasts, videos, even style tips. I mean, he's a styling guy. He's only going to send you one newsletter a month. It always is jammed with really interesting stuff. And you know, if he recommends it, it's because he uses it. He's tried it. It has his stamp of approval. So if there's something in there you read that you like, you know this is one to try. Look at that. Who makes the best paper notebook? Is it a Moleskine or is it? You know, Kevin Rose has obsessively gone through them one after the other to figure out which one's the best, and I love that. Kevin calls the journal a newsletter for the curious. I think this is exactly, what is this? The Japanese art of Hikaru Dorodango. Don't know what it is, but if you read the journal, you will. www.shiningmudrounddumpling.
All right, there you go.
Kevin's a little strange. No, I love Kevin, and I think I love the journal. He's got now over 50,000 members. We thank you so much, and if you haven't yet subscribed, go to www.thejournal.email. He got one of those email. I thought they weren't available. Thejournal.email. He must know someone.
He knows people.
Thejournal.email. Sign up today. It's free. No salesman will call. Once a month. I can't think of any reason why you shouldn't. You got to do this. And we thank him so much for insisting on buying ads on the new screensavers. Isn't that crazy?
That's very nice.
I'd do the same for you. I'd give you a free plug, but no, I want to buy an ad. Hey, let's talk to Megan Bruck-Seil. She's a planetary scientist from Livermore. Megan, thank you for hanging on. I appreciate it.
Sure. Glad to be here.
You're part of, I'm reading this, but I almost don't believe it, U.S. government planetary defense team. This sounds like something out of a comic book.
Well, we take national security very seriously here.
I'm sorry. I'm not mocking you. I guess I'm relieved. Are we at risk from asteroids?
There are none known currently to be a risk to the Earth, but there are a lot that are still undetected at this point. They're in the hundreds to meters size range or smaller. And so we want to be prepared in the event that there is one that's going to be a hazard to the Earth.
They've hit the Earth before, right?
Oh, yeah. Big ones, yeah.
Yeah, the dinosaurs, right?
Yeah. So that's the most famous large impact of in recent, or not so recent, 65 million years ago at this point.
But yeah, but it's not fantasy. I mean, we could see the craters. We could see the results from these things. And how devastating would something like this be? Is it like in the movies?
Well, the movies clearly are going to hyperbolize some of this stuff. So clearly, what you would see in Armageddon or Deep Impact isn't a realistic portrayal of what the threat would be. At this point, anything that's a kilometer or larger in size is very well constrained. Their orbits are very well constrained. And so they're not going to be threatening the Earth anytime soon.
Oh, that's interesting. So we know where they are, and we can tell that they're not a hazard to us going distantly into the future.
Right, for the really big ones.
Okay.
Yeah, there's only so many of the really big ones. As you get down to smaller sizes, there's many more of that size range that could be a threat.
And how much of a threat? What's the scenario?
Well, so I think looking back in recent times, you can look at the Chelyabinsk impact in Russia, which occurred in 2013. That one was only about 20 meters across, wasn't detected ahead of time, clearly. Still injured about 1,500 people, mostly from blowing out windows and things.
Right.
And if it had occurred over a more populated area, it could have been much more devastating. So clearly there's a size range for which we still don't have a perfect understanding of where they are and when they're going to hit.
The mass, the great mass of these things burn up in the atmosphere. They become, you know, shooting stars, right? This is one. In fact, we have a lot of video of this because of dash cams' popularity in Russia that actually landed. Look
Jeez.
At that thing. That's scary.
That's horrifying.
So, so are you tracking objects at this small size?
So detection or tracking of asteroids is really in the realm of NASA. So NASA JPL's Near Earth Object Office pulls in observations from all of the ground-based and space-based observatories that are hunting for asteroids all the time. So they have a centralized database of all of their orbits, and so they know what are the probabilities of impact for all of these different objects. Here at the lab, we focus on if there was a one that was going to impact, what could we do to prevent it?
How interesting. So tell me about some of the... How blue sky is this? I mean, you're thinking about giant nets?
What? Laser? I mean, is there lasers? Satellites?
What kind of stuff are we talking about here?
Yeah, so the two methods that we focus on here are the two most mature technologies at this point to handle an asteroid that would be a threat. And that is, first is a kinetic impactor, which is just simply a spacecraft that would ram into an asteroid at high speed. And so it's going to... clearly deliver all of its momentum into the asteroid, but then there's this extra boost of momentum from any of the crater ejecta that is going in the opposite direction. Also, you guys have a video of this here. This is a simulation we've done at the lab using the spheroidal hydrocone. So kinetic impactor is a real simple method for deflecting an asteroid, just changing its velocity by in the order of a centimeter per second or somewhere along those lines. As long as you do it early enough, it'll move it far enough off of the Earth's path that it won't impact the Earth.
So it's basically like a snowplow, but for an asteroid, almost.
Yeah. You're just moving it very gently, and over time, that change in velocity will translate into a large distance, and it'll miss the Earth.
Yeah.
The other method, which we do a lot of simulations of this at the lab as well, is kinetic impactors can only handle asteroids that are fairly small and detected with a lot of warning time. If you have something on the larger size, more than a couple hundred meters across or so, or the warning time is shorter, we don't have the rockets to get enough mass there to move the asteroid off of an Earth impacting trajectory. So the other option is to send a nuclear device. It would be deployed some distance from the surface of the asteroid. All of the energetic particles and photons from the device would be deposited in the uppermost surface layers of the asteroid. All that material would be then vaporized and blow off in the opposite direction, and then the asteroid would recoil slightly in the other direction. So you're really keeping most of the asteroid intact. You're only affecting the surface. And the rest of the asteroid is moving in the other direction.
So it seems like it's less focused on destroying the asteroid and more just moving it out of our way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just gentle nudges.
And are you guys, in addition to looking at the Earth, are you looking at the moon as well too? Like anything? Like is that included in your detection area?
Looking at impacts on the moon,
yeah.
Or so anything that came. Within the Earth-Moon system would be...
Included.
That's pretty darn close.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
You get within
a
quarter million miles. Yeah. We're a little close for comfort.
Yeah.
How is this a new effort, or have we been doing this all along? It feels like this is something we really weren't thinking about until recently.
Yeah, I think here at the lab, people have been working on this problem for over 20 years, at least thinking about how you could use different methods to deflect asteroids. And I think as the observational capabilities have improved over the last 25 years or so, and we found more and more of these small bodies, we have a better picture of what the threat really is. And I think that Chelyabinsk's impact in Russia was a call to action for a lot of international leaders. And so there is a kind of renewed focus on what can we do to prevent it.
Do we have the capability now, or is this something we're planning for in the future? If something was coming at us and we just found out about it, what would we do today?
Right. So we have the capability now. We don't have a spacecraft sitting ready to be launched now. But so that would take something on the order of a year or two to get something on a rocket and launched. But we have the kinetic and nuclear technologies necessary to move something off of an Earth-impacting course.
Would we get a year warning? Yeah. Would we get that much warning?
We would. For deflection to work, typically you're going to need many years warning. If you have less than a year, the only option would be probably emergency response or possibly trying to disrupt it. So trying to fully fragment it and robustly disperse all of the fragments. Wow. So that's a different strategy.
There's also a laser system, is that right, or you're looking at?
So we have a facility here called the Jupiter Laser Facility, and the reason we're using that for some experiments is we're trying to understand more about asteroidal materials. So our best analogs for asteroid materials here on Earth would be meteorites that we've found. And so using these meteorite samples, we use the lasers to shock them to very high pressures and then see how they behave under these high pressure conditions, how they fragment and fail. And so we learn more about the strength models that we should incorporate into our numerical simulations by doing these experiments on realistic asteroid materials.
Megan's working at the Lawrence Livermore National Labs, which is a really amazing, just up the road a piece from us. Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of explosive work. And here's a picture of Megan with the NASA Ames. This is down in the South Bay by Google. Vertical gun range. What is that?
Oh, it's a great facility. So I did all my PhD work at Brown, working at the AVGR. We did a lot of experiments with Pete Schultz there. It's incredible. Behind you, you can see the blue thing is a giant vacuum chamber where the target would be placed. And that orange thing is a giant lever arm that can go up to different impact angles and shoot things into the target chamber at different angles. See the ports, goes through the ports.
So this is testing the effect of the impacts then?
Yes, so it was built during the Apollo era originally to simulate the craters on the moon. So to understand that.
Okay. But now being used to find out how we deflect. What are the chances, though, of this happening? Is this a high level of risk or a low? Where do we stand?
What's the mathematical probability of this?
Right. Well, for the small guys, things are 20 meters in size, like Chelyabinsk. Those are fairly frequent. Something like Tunguska, which was in the early 20th century over Siberia, that was only 70 meters and was hugely devastating. It leveled about 2,000 square kilometers of forest. So if that had happened over a metropolitan area, that could have been really horrible. And so those are not that infrequent. Clearly the ones that are much larger, hundreds of meters, those are less frequent, but the consequences are high. And so even when things are relatively low probability, if the consequences are very, very high, they bear looking at closely and being prepared for.
No kidding. Oh my gosh.
How big is the team that you're on working on all this? Like how many resources are being put towards the planetary defense?
Yeah, it's a relatively modest amount of resources here at the lab. There's a big group of people, but they work at kind of 10% or 20% time on it. But we're able to leverage a lot of different expertise by doing it in that group format, team format like that.
It sounds fascinating, actually. And it must be great on does your business card actually say Planetary Defense Group?
No.
Oh, man, come on. Gotta make up one at least, like an ID,
So when you watch movies like Armageddon or Deep Impact, is it more like eye-rolling or is it more, or can you separate it and enjoy the Hollywood fictionalization of it?
Yeah, Yeah, I think if you're able to enjoy it, view it as more fantasy and enjoy the story, it's fine. But you have to recognize that the science is inaccurate and and make sure you explain to anyone that asks that, you know, that's not how it would work in real life.
At the same time, there's some value in raising the awareness, which would help raise funding, because obviously this is something that it would be a sensible thing for governments to look at. Are other governments doing this? Is it a joint task force? I mean, it's all our Earth.
So it is ultimately an international problem, and I think a good example of how it can be dealt with internationally is the first planned test of the kinetic impactor strategy is an international mission. So it's a collaboration between the European Space Agency and NASA. This is called the AIDA mission. It's a mission to a binary asteroid, so an asteroid with a little moon around it. They're going to, the European component will go there ahead of time, characterize the system very, very thoroughly with a suite of instruments. And then the American component, the DART impactor, will come in and impact the smaller asteroid in the binary, the little moon going around the larger one. And then we'll be able to detect how much its velocity changed. So it's a real-life test of how this could work, and definitely making things international is a more realistic a capturing of the type of strategy we would need in a real event.
I think of my friend Jerry Pournelle's wonderful novel, Lucifer's Hammer, which is all about the, really less about the science of a comet impact, but more about what would happen to civilization if a big one hit us. And I'm glad we're preparing. We're considering this.
The one that made me think of the moon is Neal Stephenson's Seven Eves.
Seven Eves,
where an impact hits the moon and breaks the moon in pieces, and then everything that happens from there. And
we got to protect the whole area, here.
Jeez.
Well, it's really great to talk to you, Megan. Thank you for filling us in a little bit on your work as a planetary defender. I think you should get a suit of a uniform.
I think at least some sort of logo.
A cape,
some sort of
logo.
Oh man,
we're just teasing you. I'm really glad that this is going on. We're glad to help raise awareness. Megan Bruxile is a planetary scientist working at the Lawrence Livermore National Labs on what might happen should a body approach the Earth, and we need to move it out. What's the closest something's come and not hit us? Is there any, like, because you think of the big events, like if it were, 20 meters, 40 meters, but what if it were a kilometer across? That could conceivably end civilization as we know it, right?
Yeah, a kilometer across would have global effects. The Dinosaur Killing Impact was about 10 kilometers across, so it wouldn't be that magnitude.
So it's big. Yeah, that was big. So, have we had close encounters? I mean, have we just dodged a bullet, or in our recent memory, or
are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, it's a secret.
None of this is a secret. You can check the JPL Near Earth Object website and look at all the orbits and look at the past, present, and future orbits to see when a variety of size bodies come close to the Earth. But things come regularly inside of the Earth-Moon radius. So things come by pretty close sometimes, and it just depends on their orbit, whether they're really going to be a threat. So the distance it gets to the Earth is and will be a threat is also determined by its specific orbit. Yeah.
This is all I know about asteroids.
Yeah,
right?
This is the closest
I've ever come.
We have one of those little triangle ships?
we need more. Megan, thank you so much for joining us on the new Screensavers. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Take care. Well, no, stop it with the asteroids. It's fun to hear that again, isn't it?
I'm glad that we have people doing that.
You know, I didn't know we did.
I have no idea either.
We're just kind of waltzing through space hoping nothing bad happens. No, we got some smart people.
Yeah, which is good.
Paying attention.
Which is good, because God forbid something actually happens, we need to keep Aerosmith from recording a new song.
Oh, my God.
That's the utmost important.
And Bruce Willis isn't going to live forever, folks. All right. Coming up, I got a new sweet machine. It's a laptop from HP. I'm going to give you a review and tell you the one thing that makes it a do not buy.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it makes me sad. And then you and I are going to play with something new from Logitech that isn't exactly a revelation for Android owners, but I'm really happy to have it in my car. We'll talk about that in just a second. First, I want to talk about our desks that we're going to get in the new studio. I'm so excited. Maybe you watched Silicon Valley.
Of course.
You saw the Pied Piper, the new, that spiffy new office they had with a chef and everything. Did you notice the desks?
I did.
Those are Varidesks, my friends. Those are standing desks, actually standing and sitting. They're adjustable desks that let you work however you want. But studies show, and there's lots of medical studies show, that sitting all day at your desk, that sedentary lifestyle is bad for you. Heart disease, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, all the things that are about to kill me because I spent too much time sitting down. We know that standing up is good for you. So what if you had a desk that lets you do both? And that's how the Varidesk works. It can go right on top of your existing desk, so no boss approval needed for this. It doesn't have to be assembled. We're not talking about some crazy IKEA experiment here. This comes in the box, ready to go. You lift it up, put it on your desk. Now you can put your monitor on there. You can put a laptop on there, and you can raise it and lower it. There are 11 different positions. It's easy to do. Now, it's very stable, so you have to release. I keep saying with one finger. It wouldn't take a lot of effort, but it does take two hands because you have to release two clasps on either side of it and then raise it or lower it. But even if you've got a lot of weight on there, it goes very, very easily. That's the Exec 40. That only has 9 settings. So it depends on the Varidesk you get. They do start as little as $175. Free shipping in the continental United States. Lifehacker picked it as one of their top 5 standing desks. It's also been featured on Product Hunt and Gear Patrol, and as I mentioned, on Silicon Valley. And we're really pleased that we have been able to talk them into helping us in our new studio. Because all the employees, we have these Varidesks, and they go, wow, I want this for my desk. So all of our desks at the new studios will be sitting, standing desks. And you choose. Maybe you had a long day, a long night, and you want to sit down today. You just lower it. But if you want to stand up and get your blood going and feel good, you raise it up. It's such a great idea. Check it out, Varidesk, Varidesk.com. They have a wide range of standalone desks plus desks you put on top of your existing desk, and they're all affordable and they work great. Varidesk.com. So I was really excited. I am a MacBook fan. I like the thin and light MacBook. And I got very excited about the idea of a thin and light MacBook style computer from other manufacturers. When I saw the ad for this, and maybe I showed the video of it, and HP did a real Apple style ad with it's pouring melted copper.
I saw that.
Yeah. And they claim it's the thinnest laptop made. This is 10.4 millimeters. That's a little deceptive because, like all of these new things, it's tapered. Yep. That's 10.4 millimeters, but as you get into the middle, it gets thicker. And in fact, it is a little bit thicker by a millimeter than a MacBook. That's not too bad. It's still very thin. 2.5 pounds is a little heavier than a MacBook, but you get a larger screen. This is a 13-inch 1080p IPS LCD screen. It's actually a gorgeous looking screen. Not touch, which is for Windows 10 a little surprising, but frankly, I don't mind that. Touch screens get a little fingerprinty. I use it occasionally on a laptop. I could live with this not being touch. It does have a really superb keyboard. In fact, better than the MacBook's keyboard. Apple made some sacrifices. When you're this thin, you're not going to have a lot of key travel, and Apple decided to make it kind of make a blessing out of that curse by doing a whole new key spring design that is very firm and holds it. And I find it actually hard to type accurately on a MacBook.
I'm not a big fan of the MacBook.
It feels like your fingers are bouncing off. Yeah. This one is the old traditional style, kind of wobbly key springs, but there's more travel. And actually, it's very usable. Also, another thing that a lot of Windows laptops get wrong, the trackpad. This is a glass trackpad, much like Apple's, and it feels great, and it works great, and it's very responsive. So I give it, two thumbs up in terms of two index fingers up in terms of the keyboard and the trackpad. Really done a nice job with that. The other thing I found interesting, Apple kind of implied that, it's so thin, we can only have one Type-C connector. You couldn't have two on here. So when I saw that HP put three on the back of their this is the HP Spectre 13T, by the way. It's kind of hard to figure out because they've made Spectre 13Ts before.
It's the latest.
I don't know get the one that looks like it's made out of copper. But there are three ports on here. All three of them are Type C. I'm a big fan, as I'm sure you are,
of
the Type C connector, right? And you know, because you have a Robin, we all have now lots of these Type C cables around. On the MacBook and the Chromebook Pixel, both of which use Type C power adapters, you can plug any Type C power brick, even one for your phone, into there. It won't charge very fast, but at least it'll charge a little bit. And I thought, well, that's going to be great. And because I have three, all three of which can be used to charge, I've got real flexibility. And here's the best part. This is running the new Skylake processors from Intel. Those Skylake processors support Thunderbolt 3, 40 gigabits per second. Apple, unaccountably, in their updated MacBook, didn't take advantage of that. There's still Thunderbolt 2. But these two ports are Thunderbolt 3 ports. And I've tried it with my Akitio Thunderbolt 3, and it's amazing. Throughput. All of the 40 gigabits really makes it great. These are also, as with most Type-C connectors, multi-use. So you can power, you can charge a phone from it, you can charge into it. I mean, that's very flexible. You could drive a monitor through it as well. I mean, the Type-C really is a great connector. But here's the one. So in every respect, this is nice. If you want a Windows 10 laptop, it's light. It's very executive. I like these kind of barrel hinges. They're kind of weird looking. They're not functionally you know, significant, but they're pretty. Admittedly, and HP even said this, all this chrome on here is just a fingerprint magnet. Yeah. They said, yeah, we know, but what are you going to do? You know, it looks great. You just wipe it off a lot. This is, I think, aimed at an executive.
It's the luxe kind
it's
of approach
the luxe.
To design.
But
right?
it's pretty,
yeah.
isn't
yeah,
it?
It's nice.
And it's so light. I mean, it really is. So here's the one negative that just drives me nuts, and I wish HP had done something about this. So here's the Type-C dongle that comes from HP, and I can put it in any of these three Type-C ports, and it'll charge it. But put your Mac dongle in there, put your Pixel dongle in there, put any other Type-C charger. HP says, sorry, wrong charger. They
so
have
it's a
put,
proprietary charger.
They have put circuitry into their charger, even though it's a non-proprietary connector, to keep it proprietary. That's something that frosts me.
Why would they do that?
Because they make $90 every time you buy another charger.
So it comes with one.
comes with one, and if you wanted to buy a second, you'd have to get it from HP. And I was hoping that I could bring this home, charge it with my Pixel charger, bring it to work, charge it here. No. And, you know, it's not the end of the world, and yet it's enough for me to ding them, because there's just it's this thing we're talking about where it's not customer first. It's a little bit about greed, if you ask me.
And honestly, $90 for another charger, is that really going to make their quarterly sales?
Right. They could do the right thing and give users what they want. They may have an excuse like, well, if you used a non-HP charger, you could break it or something like that. But Apple didn't do that. If anybody was, you know, nanny protectionist, it would be Apple. They didn't do that. Pixel, Google didn't do it. I think the Type-C standard is well enough understood that it can be used
although,
to charge.
In their defense, and I know very little about this, there was that hubbub.
So Benson Leung, the Google engineer who was testing all the Type-C cables. Yep. But that was a very specific situation, going from the old USB connector to a new Type-C connector. And it was, for instance, let's say I wanted to charge a phone from my MacBook. If you had a bad cable, you could hurt the MacBook by connecting it to something that drew too much power. That's not what we're talking about here. Right. This is a power charger. Yeah. That's not the risk.
Right.
So, and they still let you charge your phone with a bad USB Type-C cable if you want.
They're not stopping you from doing that.
They didn't stop that. So that's not, you know, I thought too, maybe that's the reason. I can't, you know, I asked Paul Theroux, he's going to ask HP maybe, and if they say, oh, if they give me a good rationale, okay, I'll take it back. So on the pros and cons, I mean, the thinness and lightweightness are great. This is comparable to MacBook with an even bigger screen, and I think in some respects a better screen. It's not Retina, it's 1080p, but I don't mind not having a Retina screen. That confuses a lot of software with the pixel doubling and all of that. This works great. 1080p is plenty. I don't know when we got so crazy
especially at that size.
1440 and all that. Yeah, and it's light. Here, go ahead and feel it. It feels good. It
feels
looks
great,
good.
Actually.
I think
Jeez.
It's something you'd be proud to carry.
Yeah.
So in every respect, it's got a great keyboard. It's got a great trackpad. The negatives, there's no touch. That's not so bad. And that weird thing that you have to use their proprietary charger. When you put a non-proprietary, when you put an open port on here, you just, I think you're setting up an expectation this is going to be a standard. And I'd like to see that. We've finally got to that point on phones where you don't have to buy a proprietary charger for a phone.
The word universal.
Universal.
Should mean universal.
All laptops. And, you know, Dell and everybody else, they have their proprietary charger. But I was just hoping Even yeah. Apple does. I was just hoping that just for once that they'd follow in the lines of the MacBook and the Pixel C and put a non-proprietary yeah. universal charger on here, and they didn't. So buy or don't buy. Well, I'm not a big Windows 10 fan, but if you need a Windows 10 laptop that is pretty, light, functional, I think this is excellent. You know, I'll show you another reason why we're disappointed. This is a, we bought, you know, John went out and bought this. This is an Anchor adapter. It, you know, this would work great on an Apple MacBook because it has a Type-C on this end. And then on this side, it's got a full HDMI out. We were that's just cool. using that. It's got two USB 3.1 adapters. Yeah. That's got all the throughput. And then it's got a Type-C. And the idea is this would be a pass-through. You'd put your HP adapter into here. You'd connect it to your HP. Now I've got a docking port. I could do all that stuff. It doesn't work. Even if you use the HP adapter and plug it into here, it doesn't work. And you have to put this in a separate port.
Does HP sell a dongle like that?
Oh,
does
I bet they do.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
I bet they do.
Yeah.
A pass-through dongle yeah. that'll let... Because they've obviously put some chip in there that yeah. says, hey, yeah, I'm an official HP product. Yeah. Anyway, you know, I still... I guess I shouldn't really say I'm going to make it a do-not-buy just because of that one thing. As long as you know what you're getting. Yeah, there it is. There's your special adapter. As long as you know what you're getting into, I think this yeah. is a definite buy. It's a beautiful laptop. HP, to their credit, did not load it up with crapware. That's often a problem on Windows PCs. Yeah. There's Norton, easy to uninstall. Not Norton, I'm sorry. McAfee antivirus, easy to install. I installed it immediately. HP has put LoJack on here. That's in the firmware. Didn't worry about that so much. And I think there's an HP updater. I took most of it off. It was at all uninstalled. There's one other note, and this is to be determined. I've been trying to put Linux on here. And I have not been able to yet. I think it's brand new and it's highly proprietary. So it's don't buy it for a Linux laptop, at least not yet. Wait till whatever, you know, the drivers, the non-free drivers or whatever.
You recommended updates on, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's Windows 10. Yeah. It's Windows 10. Don't put that Windows 7 on here.
No.
All right. A definite buy for the HP. Oh, and price-wise, it's comparable to a MacBook. Starts at $1,299. The one I have in here. Oh, that's the other thing. One more thing. They have better processors than the MacBook offers. I put the top-of-the-line mobile Skylake processor, the M7, in here. So very fast. NVMe SSD, just like the Apple. So a very fast SSD. This thing flies.
Yeah.
It feels good. It's a nice laptop. All right. We are going to do another review. Really? We're going right to another review? You really want to hear more of me? All right. Come on over here. I want to show you something. This is actually pretty cool, too. It's Leo review time.
All right.
You tell me.
In the fields.
As an all about Android host.
Yes.
You can get your Android phone when you drive in the car to receive text and read them to you, right?
Right.
Yep. Something like Agent, that's the software I used to use.
There's a bunch of different apps that do that as well.
Yeah.
As well as there's also just the regular, you know, when I had my my G-Watch. When I had,
you could say OK Google to the watch.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I've had all that, and I've used all that. And, of course, I pair this to my Bluetooth system in the car. Yeah. But I thought this was kind of cool when I saw the ad for this. This is Logitech's Zero Touch. It is a mounting system for an Android only. This won't work with iOS. That does some interesting things. Now, it doesn't do anything you can't do with the existing Android software. But for $60, I thought this was kind of interesting. So, first of all, this thing's a monster magnet. And it comes in the box with two pieces of metal that you can stick to the back of your phone. I chose the littler one. There's a larger disc. This actually works through cases. Well, I'll show you. It's on there pretty good. And this is, they make one that you glue to your dash, but this is the one for the air vent. So watch, we've simulated an air vent. This is the dashboard of my Audi A8. You've probably seen this. It's just a great little car with lots of wonderful...
So realistic.
Yeah, so realistic. There's the gear shift. Yeah, it's good. It's good. I think it has... Does it have a horn?
I think the battery is drained.
Oh, there's no battery. All right. Well, you didn't put the batteries in. What good is it?
Oh, wait. There you go. On the right. There you go. The yellow switch on the right.
Oh, I didn't turn it on. You got to turn the car on first.
And then there's a primer.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There you go.
Oh. There you go. It's working. Oh, I love it. All right. So I'm not going to, this thing doesn't, I don't know why it doesn't have Bluetooth, but I'm going to just plug in a little thing so you can hear what's going on. So watch what happens. Actually, get this shot from over my shoulder here, because as soon as you put this on the magnet and mount it, the Logitech software starts up. And I, of course, one of the nice things about Android, you could say, hey, unlock whenever you're paired to a known Bluetooth.
Using the smart lock function.
Smart lock. Yep. So this, as soon as you pair it to this, this device is actually paired now via Bluetooth LE. So it unlocks the phone. So I'm driving along, and I say, oh, I'd like to send my friend Ron a text. It has two different ways to wake it up, neither of which involves touch. One is to wave your hand.
Leo, what's up?
Tell Ron he's a good-looking fella.
Your message is, he's a good-looking fella. Should I send it?
Yes. Yes, send that.
Message sent.
She has kind of a fast pace to her speech, right?
She does, yes. Yeah. So there it is. And
there it is. Now, so I didn't touch it. I just waved it. Now, watch. When Ron sends me a message back...
Right. So now, hypothetically, I'm driving, and I should not be texting you.
You should not be texting.
I should not, but I'm from New York, and I'm very good at this, so...
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Until you're not.
So I'm going to write back. I'm going to say, why, thank you, Leo.
So then this is thing I think is really important. It now is receiving that text message, and it's going
to
wake up.
Do you want to hear the Hangouts message from Ron Richards?
Yes.
Why, thank you, Leo. Would you like to reply?
No. So we could have a whole conversation.
Ron Richards says, why, thank you, Leo. What would you like to say?
Nothing. Cancel.
Your message is nothing. Should I send it?
Yes. By the way, this is a bug.
Right, yeah.
For some reason...
Sorry, should I send your message?
Yes.
Message sent.
So that's a bug because for some reason, every time I get a message, it does it twice and it gives me a chance to respond twice. There are other things it can do. So the besides the wave, there's also you just hover your hand over it. They call it high five, and that will wake it up as well. You get to change that in the settings. I can have it play music.
Hi, Leo. What's up?
Listen to Spotify. It supports Spotify and Deezer and Pandora. I can have it send messages. I can have it read me messages. I can have it navigate, and you can say whether you want to use Google Maps or Waze. I like it that it lets me use Waze. So it has a, and I'll go, actually, this would be a good time to kind of show the software a little bit. I think the software is pretty good. There's that weird bug, which I'm sure they will fix at some point. You could choose the interaction mode to, of course, if you, I have it on full prompts, but you can have it on simpler prompts if you want. Choose your activation gesture. You can also tell it, if you're driving, don't ask me, don't read to me, just send a reply, I'm driving.
The auto response.
And it will auto response, which I think is really great. Yeah. It supports music, messaging, navigation. I think this is, for $60, kind of a fun thing. And the idea is, because it's got the mount, it's kind of both a mount and a system that will automatically do. I think for $60, that's worth it.
It's an added level of safety. Because the thing is that when you're using your phone in the car, especially if you're driving, you shouldn't be using the phone. That's the key thing.
Right.
And what this allows you to do is it allows by the pairing with Bluetooth and the control of turning the phone on when never taking your hands off the wheel. Because even if I have Agent or I'm using Google or I'm using voice search, I need to get the phone out of my pocket. Yep. I need to unlock it. I need to go to what I'm doing. And every time I'm doing that, I'm taking my eyes off the road. And so this way you can do it while you're just driving straight.
Most of the time your air vents are on either side of your steering wheel, so you can position it in a nice place. I have it right here. I like the idea that it's right there and I can see it. For instance, if I...
Leo, what's up?
Navigate to work.
Navigating to work.
Yeah, I'm here, obviously. But if I have Waze running, the fact that it's there and it's on the screen and I can see it, I think is really, really great. I just love that. And, I'm here.
There you go. Your travel time is 1 minute.
1 minute. I am already here.
And it's nice because, I hate air vent mounts.
This one's pretty good,
But I like they also have the option for one that is just in Dash or down in the console or whatnot. Yeah, so you've got options.
The negative on air vent mounts, besides the fact that they're a little funky, is they do vibrate. vibrate a little bit. And so your phone is, but this is a great magnet. It's on there pretty good. And I was even able to use it with my case on. So there's enough juice to hold the phone, although maybe not quite as stable. Right. So that's the Logitech Zero Touch Air Vent. They also, as you said, have one on the dash. It does calling, too. I could have it call you texting, music, and navigation.
It would be nice to see Google Play Music support on the music side.
I mean, I don't understand why it doesn't have that.
Yeah, Spotify is great, but it supports Google Maps, so why not Google Play Music?
I would guess that's in the works. Yeah, if enough people buy this, Logitech might add some more features. Not available on iOS because Apple really doesn't let you do that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Tell Jay Adelson that, all right? Anyway, that's two reviews, but definitely a thumbs up. A must-buy, I think, the Zero Touch Air Vent. We're going to get to the mailbag.
Cool.
We got two questions for you.
Bring them on.
Let's walk on over. Tell everybody about my doorbell. I'm kind of become a fan of this Internet of Things stuff. I've got the Ring Video Doorbell. This thing is amazing. Go to ring.com/NSS. It's a doorbell that replaces your existing doorbell, whether you have wired or not, because it's got a built-in lithium-ion battery, so it can go for a full year between charges. Great way to add a doorbell when none exists. But if you have a wired doorbell, it's a simple thing. Remove it and put the ring on there. I did it myself, and I'm no handyman. The nice thing is now I have not just a doorbell that I hear throughout my house, because it still works as your regular doorbell did, but also I hear it on my phone or my tablet, my iOS, my Android device. I know when somebody's at the door, even when I'm not home. It rings here when I'm at work or on the road or anywhere around the world because it's using the Internet. It's tied into your Wi-Fi. It's also got a great HD camera on it, 720p wide-angle camera, so you see everything going on your front stoop. It has a speaker and a microphone. Now, here, this is great. Today, for instance, the UPS guy came and a delivery I really wanted. I was at work. I said, yeah, I'm in the shower. Put it on the porch. And he knows me. He hears my voice. He figures, okay, that's fine. I'll leave it there. You can keep an eye on your house at all times. It's got motion detection. So if somebody walks up to your door but doesn't ring the doorbell, you'll know it. You can even talk to them if they don't ring the doorbell. The Ring Video Doorbell, now the Ring Video Doorbell Pro with 1080p video, is a great, great thing. And not just for yourself, but for family members, maybe a mother or father who are maybe a little skittish about security. I'm sending my mom one. I think she would love this. Who's there? Who's there? Ring Video Doorbell. Check it out at ring.com/NSS. And we're going to get you free FedEx shipping on the original Ring Video Doorbell when you go to that address. ring.com/NSS. It is a great device. I want to remind you about our T-shirts. They're only available for, about another week? A Teespring, T-E-E. Did you get one? Teespring.com?
Very cool shirts.
Aren't they
very
nice?
Cool.
Yeah. We call them our World Tour shirts. the reason is, on the back, it has all the shows, including All About Android. Yep. And on the front, of course, it's this first time we've ever admitted, really, we're IPTV.
It's
what it is. Yep. These shirts will, as with all of our shirts, only be available for 1 month, and then we're never making them again. So it's a collector's item, but you only have till June 12th. And we decided to keep the price low on this, just $20.
That's good.
TEESpring.twit if you want the Twit T-shirt. Time for the mailbag. Roll it in. Nice job, Tanya. Very good shot. No stubbed fingers this time. Don't know what that is. Oh, it's a laser.
Laser pointer.
I'm going to aim this right at you and blind you. Oh, thank you. Oh, it doesn't work. Oh, this is a green one.
Oh, it's a green laser.
Oh,
look at that.
Ooh, those are highly illegal.
That is.
Don't aim this at low-flying aircraft, kids. They go to jail for the rest of your life. The Waz loves these.
Yeah.
He's crazy about it. So,
all right.
Take your pick.
Let's take that one.
All right. Start the mailbag. Whose laser is this? Do I get to keep it? I do. I got it now. It's mine now, baby.
So, first one is a question from video. Oh. Ralph from Maryland had a question about Chromebooks in a video mail.
Let's take a look.
Hello, Leo and Ron. And Screensavers family there at Twit Network. This is Tom Burrow out in Maryland, out in the mountains of Western Maryland, near Frederick, Maryland. And I've been hearing all kinds of good things about the Chromebooks that are out now and upcoming shortly. And I've been having all kinds of problems with my Nexus 9, graphics problems and heating problems. So I'm in the market for a Chromebook. So what would be the best Chromebook to get now or wait? And thank you very much, and keep up the great work out there.
Well, you're the guy. Are you a Chromebook user?
I'm not a Chromebook user. I have a Chrome box that I play with at home.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was just very neat.
That's it's like a little
desktop. Yeah,
desktop,
like
and you hook it up to a computer.
Exactly. I've got a little. I got the switch to bounce between my Mac and that one.
Yeah.
But I feel bad that Ralph is having trouble with his Nexus 9 because I am a loyal Nexus 9.
Are
tablet.
You?
Love my Nexus 9.
I thought the Nexus 9 people didn't really take off.
So they recently took it out of the Google Play Store, and our good buddy Ron Amadeo from Ars Technica wrote a very scathing obituary for the device and called out a lot of the problems that it had. It had problems with some light leakage in the bezel and it felt weird in the back with the case. I never had a problem with that device. I'm using it today, in fact. That's what I've been using as my main driver recently, just because it's just a great device. So sadly that Ralph is having trouble with his Nexus 9, but if you're in the market for a Chromebook, now is the best time, because at Google I.O. just a week ago, they announced that you'll now be able to run Android apps on Chromebooks. We've been speculating how Google was going to merge Chrome OS and Android as operating systems, and this is how it's going to be. So right now, there are three Chromebooks that will work with Android apps. There's the Google Chromebook Pixel, of course, the Asus Chromebook Flip, and the Acer Chromebook R11, I believe, The R11 is the one that works currently right now.
That is not really an issue, because it's not. This is for developers only. You have to run in dev mode.
Right.
In September, it goes out.
It will go out wide, right?
Chrome OS
exactly,
wide,
yeah.
And that's going to support a much broader range. Not all, but a much broader range.
Yeah, and that actually, that page that we just had up listed, there's a much larger list of devices that will have support for Android apps later in 2016.
Have you figured out what the common thread is in these?
In what's that?
Why is it these and not many other? Like the original Chromebook Pixel?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's got to be something on the OS level. It's got to be something in Chrome OS, the way it's working with, the way the background plumbing is working and making the runtime and that sort of thing. I don't know what the special magic that makes those three work and currently right now and not the other three.
I can understand why they don't want to support the whole list in the developer program. And by the way, all three of the first ones are touch screens.
Yeah. Yep.
And so that makes sense. Android is a lot easier to use with touch, I would imagine, although the mouse will work. You don't have to have touch. I think any new Chromebook that you bought would work.
It's such a key change to the way it works. It's so important to the to the Chrome OS and Chromebooks moving forward that within 6 months every Chromebook will support this. That said, from my experience, I think the Pixel C is a great piece of hardware.
Well, if you can afford it, the one to buy.
Yeah, exactly.
I love my Pixel C.
If you can't,
Pixel C,
yeah.
Wait a minute, the tablet.
The Chromebook Pixel.
He's showing it wrong. Please don't buy the Pixel C, whatever you do.
That's a really nice. It's a really nice piece of hardware. But
I love the Pixel C, but everybody else hated it.
The Pixel is great,
but that's Android itself. Yeah. We're talking about Chromebook.
Yeah. But I found the Acer Chromebooks to be really solid. Their line, the R11 one. If I was going to buy one tomorrow, I'd probably pick up an Acer.
Yeah, if you wanted to buy a Pixel Chromebook, the 2015s will work.
Yep.
That's what I use. I love it. But they started $1,000, a lot more expensive. And I don't know if it's worth $1,000, five times more than the least expensive. I don't think it's five times better than the least expensive. That's the one that will work. I think the Acer, what I love to see is that both HP, Dell, and Acer are coming out with aluminum Chromebooks that are kind of mid-range specs at $400, $500. If you could afford a little bit more, it might be worth it. I'm going to say get one with 4 gigs of RAM.
Yes, agreed. Yeah.
And probably 32 gigs of storage minimum. Yeah. So that's going to raise the ante a little bit.
Yeah.
Because you're going to want a little extra storage once you start putting Android apps on there.
But even it's funny because Chromebooks have been around for years now, and like I said earlier, with the low priced Android phones, now is probably the best time to get a Chromebook because you've got such a wealth of manufacturers, such a wealth of options in terms of the hardware specifications, and now with this addition with Android apps, the Chromebook is finally hitting maturity where before it was kind of a unique why does that exist type thing.
So. I'll tell you, I would buy another Chromebook Pixel. I know they're $1,000. they're so well made. The screen is so great. I just love that.
The thing that stopped me from going full Chromebook was that I was doing video editing, photo editing, like stuff in Photoshop. And honestly, the apps are getting to the point now where I would probably switch to a Chromebook over my Mac OS X, you know, kind of MacBook Pro, and not really miss a beat. Other than really intense video editing and effects, you know, kind of really, you know, processor intensive stuff. But I should be doing that on a desktop anyway. So,
and Android, suddenly you got Photoshop Mix, you've got Snapseed, you've got probably all the photo editing you ever want.
So many options there.
You don't have Lightroom, you don't have Photoshop, but you have some pretty
good
choices.
There's Lightroom Mobile.
And then I guess for video editing, there aren't any really good options.
But I hate video editing on a laptop anyway. So, I mean, that's always, I want more. Yeah. I've got my 25-inch monitor at home on my desktop that I'll do that on.
I believe, should be buying Chromebooks, should not be buying full general-purpose operating systems with all the complexity and the cost and the risk, the security risk, that even OS X and certainly Windows entails. Most people would be better off. If you can do everything you want to do in the Chrome browser on your desktop computer, get a Chromebook. You'll save money. You'll be more reliable. It's just so much of a better choice. Here's another one for you, because I don't think I know the answer, even though I have this phone. Michael in Des Moines, Iowa, has a Nexus 6P. That's the top-of-the-line Nexus device right now. He says there's one thing missing, the option to restart instead of shut down. You know, a lot of Android devices, if you press and hold the power button, you get the option to shut down or restart.
Some of them do. Some of them have.
But not all of them.
Not all of them.
Is that built into...
So it's not built in the... Like, if you press the power button, you won't get... You can't just turn something on to get the option to reboot or power off. But with the Nexus 6P, if you hold the power button for 8 seconds, it'll reboot.
Oh.
So... There you
go. It's a hidden feature.
It's a little hidden kind of thing. And that doesn't work on all Android phones. Like, for example, on my Nextbit Robin, I held the power button for about 30 seconds, nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
It's not enabled there. But on the 6P, you absolutely, if you hold it down for 8 seconds, it will reboot.
I've had a 6P for a long time since it came out. Yep. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there you go.
And there's nowhere in the settings that you can restart.
Nope.
So I guess what Michael's been doing all this time is shutting it off.
Right.
Press the power button and then pick shut down.
And then booting
and then turning it on again.
And then waiting 10 minutes for it to boot back up, because that's the one which given how much work they're doing on Android N around the upgrading of the OS and getting rid of that optimizing apps
that
takes 45
nice.
Minutes. I'm hoping the boot process gets faster too down the line, because it takes forever for the phone to boot up.
So. One of the reasons it takes a long time on the Nexus devices is because they're encrypted volumes. Yeah. And so they run a little bit slower because of that, unfortunately. Yeah. So. It's nice to have the Android expert here, isn't it? Ron Richards.
It is the dominant OS. It is the one with the most number of users. So,
so is McDonald's, the most number of hamburgers. Sure. Does not necessarily mean quality. I have to tell you.
But, you know, it was great to be here. It's always fun.
So. Always fun.
Yeah.
Ron is regular on All About Android every Tuesday, 5 p.m. Pacific.
5 p.m.-ish. On Tuesdays.
When they get around to start. I'm the last guy to complain about that.
That's true. Yeah, no, we have a great time. Me and Jason and Florence Ion and various guests. Yeah, we have a lot of
really
fun on that show.
Team.
And it's after coming out of Google I.O., there's just been so much to talk about. Yeah. And it's a great time to be talking Android. So,
he's the original comic book guy, everybody.
So. Yeah, go to ifanboy.com. Check that out. We just reviewed X-Men Apocalypse. We just reviewed Preacher. We just reviewed Captain America. Plus all the week's comic books. DC Rebirth. All the exciting stuff. So. Captain America is a bad guy. It's crazy. So
I don't get the comic book.
Yeah, yeah, it's a world. So there you go. Check it out, ifanboy.com.
Nice. That's your podcast.
That is, yeah.
So. Thank you all for being here. We do the new Screensavers every Saturday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. If you want to tune in live, we'd love it if you're in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. But if you can't be here live or in studio with us, we've got the Sons of Arthritis, the motorcycle gang is here. It's a small gang. That's the ibuprofen chapters here. And it's one guy, basically. But if you can't be here in studio or watch live, don't forget on-demand audio and video is always available. twit.tv/NSS or use your favorite podcast application. They're everywhere. We're on every one of them. You can subscribe, and that way you won't miss an episode. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye.